This is fun! The FU Network!
Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen.
I'm Stephen Kersner, and I guess the best way I would describe myself for purposes of this show is a political satirist.
Sure, why not? And Stephen Lawton's. I'm just the other guy.
Yeah, the other guy who happens to be a very well-respected lawyer and...
Those two words don't ever go together.
Font of knowledge on politics and Canadian political history. So this is a show that... Stephen and Stephen is a show that... we both started a while ago on another network.
And we started it for the last, for not this election, but the previous election. In fact.
That's right. Yeah, way back. And we did it just because
2015.
You and I liked to talk about politics, and we thought maybe some people would be interested in hearing.
Listening in on what we have to say.
And we had a good audience. And then we both got torn in different directions, had things to do as life, you know, tends to do. And so the show stopped, and now we're starting it again. And yes, people listening, yes, we are two white guys talking politics, though with me being Jewish, it's debatable whether I am actually white. It depends on who you ask and what time of day, because I've been told I'm white at some time. Other times I've told I'm not white. So I suppose it depends on somebody's particular need or use for ethnicity at that particular time.
And I'm white. I'm white any time of the day. I am just, you know, I'm so white that, you know, I'm you can get snow blindness looking at me.
Okay. So yes, we own our ethnicities. We own our backgrounds. We own our air quotes privilege. But I don't think that should take away from the validity of the things that we're saying or the opinions that we have. I don't think that skin color really should factor into that. Definitely, if you listen to the rest of the FU network, FU politics, there's probably more people of color than white people on those panels. So everybody's represented, because we believe that voices, everybody experiences life through their own lens, and whatever makes you unique or distinct is going to change your lens, and that brings a quality to the discussion. And Stephen and I both have different lenses. Me coming from a television and comedy background, Stephen coming from a legal background. And today we're going to talk about, I'll put it this way. During the ritual known as a Passover Seder for Jews, there's a point where the youngest child asks, why is this night different from all other nights? And today we're going to ask, why was this election different from all other elections? Because, and maybe it wasn't. Stephen, you have a much longer view, and you're much more historically attuned.
Well, you call me old.
No, you're I actually think you're just educated.
Okay.
You're definitely more well-read on the history of Canadian politics, and I defer to you on that. Do you think this election was notably different than previous ones?
I think there's several things that made it different. You know, some of it's variations on a theme, but I think there's a couple of things that were just very, very substantially different about this election. I mean, you know, number one, the outcome, another minority government, you know, that's different, but it's not unprecedented. We've had, you know, various minorities, some of them very productive, some of them fairly long-lived, some of them fairly short-lived, as Joe Clark found out. but, you know, I think the outcome makes it a little different, but I think the way the campaigns were run was really, really different. I did a little podcast a little while ago about this being Canada's first post-factual election. It really was run in a way that would have made the Republicans to the south of us very, very proud, because the Conservatives particularly ran a campaign that was based, you know, not just on torquing the truth and spin and all the rest, but on a concerted policy of running a campaign based on lies. I mean, just stuff that was completely untrue, stuff that they knew was untrue, and they ran with it because they thought it would get votes. And, you know, politicians lying, you know, not exactly news, but the way that it was done as sort of an official policy of the Conservative Party in this election was I think unprecedented. And I hope it's a one-off. I hope the lack of success that it was met with in Canada maybe a lesson to the conservatives. Although conservatives, whenever they lose an election, they always regroup. I saw they were regrouping just this week at the Albany Club to do a postmortem and to, you know, get a couple of kicks in at Scheer, and he was doing his mea culpas in front of the Tory brass. And the problem that conservatives always have is when they run a campaign like this, and they ran one that was pretty far to the right, they always get back together and go, what did we do wrong? What we did wrong was we weren't right-wing enough.
Yes, that seems to be the pattern. I mean, Tim Hudak did that in Ontario when he could have very well been the premier, but he decided that the previous campaign wasn't right-wing enough. He went further right than Ontario was comfortable with and lost, and we got 4 more years of Liberal government in Ontario. We had Stephen Harper, who was much more scientific and methodical, much smarter person than Andrew Scheer or his team, and yet he okayed that barbaric cultural practices hotline and all these dog whistles that just rang to Canadians as, this is not Canadian, this is not fair, it's hitting below the belt, it's divisive, this is not who we are, and he lost. And now we've got a second loss where the team did not learn from the previous loss and instead went full tilt, putting all the emphasis on the things that lost them the election last time. And as you say, the difference is that I think political spin is a respectable art form. Taking the facts as they are and putting a face on them that best suits you. That's part of politics. Spin is part of politics. But we went away from spin and went to just absence of facts altogether, just lies, because they know, as Winston Churchill said, a lie can get halfway around the world before the truth gets its pants on. And with the internet, that's more true than ever. And they know that they can put out a headline, a tweet from the official Conservative Party of Canada Twitter website saying that Justin Trudeau is doing his best to try to secretly help Canadian ISIS fighters to get back into the country. It's not true. There's not a basis, not a shred of truth to it, but they know that even if they're forced to walk it back, it's out there. People hear that. People don't often hear retractions. They hear that and it builds. They know that just getting people to hear things, it's just like in court when they say, the objection, sustained, the jury will disregard
those last comments.
Yeah, no, they can't, because they're human beings and they've heard it. And this wasn't just a post-factual election. It was in many ways a post-issues election, because this was run very much like a campaign for class president in the sixth grade. It was based on who you associated yourself with in the leaders, who you saw yourself in with the various leaders. It was based on identity. It was inevitable American osmosis, where we've got a lot of that coming up here. And you said that the Republicans in the U.S. would have been proud of the way the Conservatives campaigned. Yeah, they would have been, because word is that a number of the consultants were American. And it seems that American consultants, political consultants, think that Canada is America Junior. And they don't understand the fundamental differences between our sense of fair play and our political system and how it works and theirs. It's just, it's that stereotypical ugly American where they think that they can just come in and do things the way they do things in America and it'll work the same way, especially in Canada. And it didn't. And who's to say that having their asses handed to them twice will get them to change their policies? It depends on who they decide to choose. We saw last week a very strong Scheer Must Go campaign being orchestrated by conservatives, young conservatives, who are not social conservatives. They're fiscal conservatives, and they want to actually win power. And they realize that a guy like Scheer, who was evasive, untrustworthy, lied, lies that we caught and lies that we didn't, but some lies were transparent, like lying on his resume, and refusing to apologize for some very offensive comments that he made about the gay community. he was just, if you look at the arcs that came out afterwards, some of the stats, it turned out that the more people got to know and got exposed to Andrew Scheer, the less they liked him.
It's absolutely true. And, you know, I think one of the heartening things about the Canadian election campaign is, you know, the Conservatives threw everything that they could at Trudeau. I mean, Trudeau's campaign, I think it was a badly run campaign, even without even without the things that got thrown, you know, the things that were within their control was badly run. They didn't run on the record. They didn't run on the economy. They didn't run on a whole bunch of things that were kind of easy winners. And instead they continued to go with sort of the social hugging, apologizing sort of thing, as opposed to, look, you've been government now, run on your record, run as a government, not run as sort of a social club.
Yeah.
And instead, because they were running such a weak campaign, every time the Conservatives threw something at them, you know, whether it was the blackface thing, and all of a sudden the Liberals are in a week long of defense, pull back, apologize mode, and they're back on their heels, and then something else comes out. And, you know, there's, the Liberals were constantly being thrown off the game by the Conservatives, who threw stuff at them. Some of it was real, some of it was not real. Like you said, you know, it takes 3 days, 4 days for the truth to come out and everyone's tired of it. They've moved on to the next scandal. And that's classic Trump. I mean, to have something outrageous five times a day so you never catch up with the first one. You're already processing, you know, the fifth one while the sixth one is coming out.
And the other five are still in people's subconscious. They get very, very sticky. They stay there. And people don't remember why they have this impression of a particular person. They just know they do. They're not aware that it's because of the constant messaging that came from their opponent that slipped under your cognitive ability to filter it, and it just sat there and formed suspicion.
Yep. And the other thing too is, I mean, there was the Whisper campaign that was going on, and while the Conservatives promoted it, I mean, you know, on the day of the English language election, they came out with this foreboding press release saying, you know, Trudeau's going to have a few tough questions to answer about his personal life when it comes to the debate. Well, you know, came out, it had nothing to do, they're going to ask more questions about SNC-Lavalin, which, you know, was old news. But at the same time, the Conservatives were using third-party proxies. Groups like the Manning Center famously gave $320,000, which included a pile of money, $250,000, to the Strong and Proud network of social media people who were putting out all of these fake memes. So they had all these third-party proxies fighting these wars for them. Some of them are just really terrible organizations, like the Buffalo Chronicle, which is just pure, it's the world of the news. It's those tabloids that you see in the checkout, used to see in the checkout at the supermarket, you know, Bat Boy marries Hillary Clinton.
That's right. Sasquatch father's child. Yes. Yeah.
It's that quality of information that they're putting out, but they're putting it out in a slickish package. They always mix it in with a little bit of real news, so you kind of look at it. I'm sure you saw on Twitter and on Facebook, you know, it was being retweeted just endlessly. I saw some stats somewhere that, you know, some of the stories, a completely fake story. Like it was looked at by every investigative journalist, every reputable investigative journalist, put people on it. This whole idea that Trudeau left his high school under a cloud, and, you know, it was either because, he was dating a soccer mom, he was dating a student. You know, there's variations on the theme. But this was pushed out, I think, by the Buffalo Chronicle, and it was being amplified through all of the Conservative.
It was helped by the fact that people were suspicious of Trudeau.
Yeah.
Because they sold him the first time around as a perfected being, which they did to Obama in the United States. And people don't realize Obama thought he was going to lose his reelection campaign. He thought he was going to lose because he raised hopes to a point that were completely unmanageable, especially in short terms as presidents and prime ministers get. He thought he was going to lose. And Trudeau was sold again as a perfected being like Obama. And inevitably, people are going to be let down, especially liberals, all of whom think that their particular issue is the issue of our time and must be the one that gets the most attention and must be the one that gets the most focus. And when it doesn't, they get angry and take their ball and go home. But here we had, they ran and then the blackface stuff happened, which is, my God, it happened. Blackface specifically happened when he was in high school. High schools exist as a place to contain teenagers when they're at the point in their life when they make the biggest mistakes of their lives, the most foolishness, because of the pressures of going from being a child to being semi-adult. I can't think of anybody I know of, and anytime I've asked this on a podcast, can anybody think of something they did? You know, can anybody say they didn't do something 20 years ago they regret now?
About Halloween costumes?
Yeah, yes. You know, or anything. But the problem with that was the brand of Trudeau that he continued to push after the last election was this one of sanctimony, this one of kneecapping the NDP by being more left than them. And it drove me crazy. As someone who tends to vote liberal, every time Justin Trudeau opened his mouth and talked about people kind and things like that, as someone who has met and known Justin Trudeau, that's not Justin Trudeau. Justin Trudeau is the guy who called Peter Kent a piece of shit in the House of Commons. That's Justin Trudeau's a real person. And this other person that the PMO was running was not the legitimate Justin Trudeau. So when it came out that he had made mistakes like everybody else, people didn't know what to trust anymore. Because which Justin Trudeau is the real one? The one back then or the one now? Obviously the one now, I think, with most people, carries more weight. But it violated his brand, whereas Scheer was never seen as trustworthy. And so when he continued to lie, it never violated his brand. People just shrugged. And the Liberals, as you mentioned, ran a bad campaign. Instead of running on what is a good record for the economy, jobs, raising kids out of poverty, they had a really good agenda to run on. And most elections are won or lost based on pocketbook issues. And the economy was doing well. Instead, they decided they're going to hang the entire election campaign again on Trudeau. And Trudeau was damaged goods. And so it was just there was not a single campaign that was well run. The NDP, 2/3, I think, of their of the ridings in Canada didn't have an NDP candidate when the writ was dropped. And the writ wasn't dropped, you know, ninja-like out of the blue. We knew when it was coming.
We have this thing called fixed election dates.
Yeah, and so, Jagmeet Singh only saved himself and his party by being personable and likable in the final English language debate at a time when everybody else was sticking to talking points and being fairly stiff. That's when the election actually began to catch fire for the NDP. But it wasn't something that was calculated. It wasn't something that was planned. He was talking about a national bike lane strategy, you know, which, you know, up in Nunavut, I'm sure they were really excited about. So one of the ways that this campaign was different is I can't remember in recent memory a federal campaign that had every party running such absolutely poor quality campaigns. And if I'd give anybody credit, I'd give the Conservatives credit, because they knew how to reach people in their gut. They knew that they were going to go low, because in the States, you know, the whole, when they go low, we go high. Well, we saw what happened there. They understood here that stuff that gets to the gut and gets past the cognitive filters and into the back of that sticky part of the brain where suspicion is, they ran a calculated campaign. It was mean-spirited and not the kind Canadians wanted, but at least there was some coordination there. Otherwise, these were campaigns that were remarkably poorly run and markedly different than previous election campaigns. Would you agree?
Yeah, and I'd say, you know, the Conservatives, I can't understand the Conservatives the way they ran their campaign, because they ran more to the right. And while the rest of the world seems to be going more to the right, generally, Canada is a little slow to adopt that. I mean, I think we have moved our center, you know, our left is now our center, so we have moved a little bit to the right, but we haven't moved that far to the right. And for Scheer to run a real right-wing dog whistle kind of campaign. You know, the same law and order, and immigrants are going to steal your sandwich and that kind of stuff that they seem to always run on. And if you want to win in Canada, you can't do, you know, you can't be the kind of socially regressive thing that he was being so coy about, whether it was about women's reproductive rights. He finally came out at the end of the day and just said, well, you know, we don't intend to change the law. Well, does that mean you won't allow any of your MPs to bring in private members' bills? Are you going to, you know, he was really, really slow in coming up with sort of a half-hearted
and unconvincing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely unconvincing, because you could almost see his eyes darting back and forth as he's answering these questions. Same on same-sex marriage and that sort of thing. You know, as people have said, those boats have long since sailed. Canadians don't want you to go back there. But it's odd that the Conservatives would continue to consolidate their base when their base, I think, is pretty safe. I mean, you certainly have, you know, like every party has its yapping dogs in the yard, and they've got their one issues, and you've got the, you know, the anti-abortion people he's got to cater to, and you've got the, you know, the, you know, I saw something just today that, you know, 27% of conservative people who identify as conservatives think that, you know, being gay should be discouraged in people. Because, you know, it's a choice. We want to encourage them to make good choices, and gay is not a good choice. So, you know, 27% of conservatives still believe that, you know, you can talk away the gay. Forget about praying away the gay. You can talk away the gay.
Yeah, it's discouraged. So, as if the things that happen to gay people when they come out to their families isn't discouraging enough.
Yeah.
You know, as if there aren't, because not all gay people live in cosmopolitan cities like Toronto, where there's a general acceptance. You know, one of our panelists grew up in a town in Saskatchewan of 400 people, and he's gay. And I said to him, that must have been fun. And you know, the notion that people should be, you know, dissuaded from it. My God, I mean, Pete Buttigieg, who's currently my favorite candidate in the United States just because of his ability to speak plainly the truth, said that for many of his years, he would have loved to have not been gay. So, you know, yes, the social conservative...
It just makes your life a whole lot easier. But, you know, but the conservatives were really leaning on those buttons hard. And you go, in an election campaign, where else are those people going to go? Who are the yellow vesters going to vote for? You
know, the concern is that they're not going to show up and vote.
Yeah, well, exactly. You've got to bring out the boat and you've got to mobilize them. And I'm sure there was an awful lot of, and this was sort of the story with the, you know, the anti-abortion group is, you know, they'd have these private meetings saying, you know, don't worry, whatever, we'll say whatever we have to get elected, but you know, we're with you kind of thing, but just, you know, keep your mouth shut during the election and we'll be able to get in and then we'll be able to do stuff. There's sort of those silent deals going on, but they became even more vocal about it. And I think, you know, they emphasized way more than they had to, and it really cost them votes, because that kind of social conservatism doesn't fly in an awful lot of Canada now. And you can see, you know, just looking at the results, where were the conservatives shut out? Urban centers. You know, the urban centers, what are they? They're multicultural. They tend to be pretty well educated. They tend to be more professional. And, you know, for them to be shut out of not just the GTA, but, you know, you go out into Peel, you go out into Hamilton, Burlington. God, Lisa Raitt loses her seat. You know, to see them being shut out in kind of red Tory areas where they held their nose and voted conservative anyway, I think really was an indication that their policies are really yesterday's policies and just aren't resonating at all anymore. And I you know, and they talk about the deficit. I think Canadians, for better or worse, are used to deficit financing. I mean, we've been running deficits since the early 1960s.
And so, it's a boogeyman anyways, because exactly. the real example of the health of an economy is your debt to GDP ratio.
Can you afford
not
your
deficit?
Debt.
Yeah.
It's like all of us. Can you afford your debt? I mean, it doesn't matter, you know, if you live in $1 million house, which is, you know, a starter home in Toronto, and you've got a $800,000 mortgage, as long as your interest rates are low and you have a good job, you can afford to pay it.
Yeah, and the idea that, you know, Doug Ford said that intergenerational debt is immoral or whatever the hell. The idea that we should cut back and for the sake of our children, create a Dickensian society now, raise them in a society where poor people don't matter and people are starving on the streets, in order to give them a future where there isn't a deficit. That's not actually doing much. The same way that deciding you don't want a mortgage because you don't want to carry the debt, so you and your kids will live on the street instead, but you're living within your means. It's stupid. It's just pulling at the heartstrings and not engaging any cognitive function.
Yeah, and the conservatives have always been great at the Dickensian part. I mean, they're really good at creating a Dickensian society. We're seeing it going on in Alberta now. Kenny and his post-election budget with the cuts, you know, always cutting the most vulnerable while there's still tons of money for oil and gas and various other corporate stuff. And, you know, even the poster child for austerity, Mike Harris added $44 billion to the Ontario deficit while he was cutting like crazy. And, you know, he had two good solid terms to do this too, to turn that ship around. And he still managed to increase Ontario's debt by $44 billion while creating this Dickensian society. I mean, if it actually had a result, you know, maybe you go, all right, well, maybe the pain's worth it. But the Conservatives are all pain and no gain.
Well, you know, if you talk about austerity, when Paul Martin was Jean Chrétien's finance minister, they made cuts. Those Liberals made cuts, and cuts that were painful. They tried to do them in a way that affected the poor and the most vulnerable as little as possible, and they offered subsidies and so on. But they made cuts, and in the end, there was a surplus rather than a deficit. And we'd started paying actual money towards the debt, not the deficit. But people still have this perception that conservatives are better with money, which maybe was true at some point in time, but has not been true for decades. Oh, yeah. And the tone of this election, that's the thing that really struck me as different. And I think this is a definite example of American osmosis, because I had never before encountered the idea that if you support Trudeau, you're a traitor and you hate Canada. I'd never before encountered a sentiment like that, that if you support X candidate of X party, you are a traitor and you hate your country. That's something we're seeing more and more, and we've been seeing for the last 4 years in the United States, helped along by Russian trolls. And this was helped by Russian trolls too. The stats are coming out now as they're able to gather them. But they weren't all trolls. They weren't all just computer-generated algorithms that were doing this. There was real people out there who really believed that if you supported Justin Trudeau, you hated your country, that he was destroying the country, and supporting him meant you hated your country. You are a traitor. And I've never seen that introduced into the Canadian political discourse before. It was always the notion that everybody had Canada's best interests at heart, but we had different ways of seeing how to get there to Canada's best interests. There were different parties had different visions of the country that varied in some respects, but in most, there was a bedrock respect that everyone shared, which was that the vulnerable need to be looked after. And there's enlightened self-interest for that. If you're, you know, a conservative and you don't have a lot of empathy, and you only care about yourself, there's enlightened self-interest reasons to have social programs. But I've never before seen a discourse where people were enemies. We weren't opponents, weren't rivals, weren't people with different opinions, enemies. And I found also that on my social media accounts, I would get the conservatives coming at me whenever I would support the Liberals or Justin Trudeau. But whenever I criticized something that the Liberals had done or that Trudeau had done, the Liberals turned as well. And, you know, like you have fallen from the lighted path, and they attacked because I wasn't just fully accepting the talking points and echoing them and using them as a megaphone. You're either with us or against us. And have you ever experienced this before? Have you ever seen this before?
No, and I got some of the same thing too, because, you know, rightly or wrongly, you know, I've been named as a liberal shill by all kinds of right and actually left-wing outlets, even though, you know, as I always say, I only speak for myself. I haven't been a member of any political party for 25, 27 years. My ideology lines up mostly with left liberal, but even though I'm identified that way by other people, I'd say liberals are running a crappy campaign, or, you know, this particular thing, the stumble, this whatever, that was a bad one, but I'm like you mentioned this earlier, I am not a one issue voter. Neither you. I look at the whole basket of things and I go, okay, yeah. So the liberals have made a whole bunch of stumbles. I don't agree with a whole bunch of stuff that they do. They're on particular issues. You know, the pipeline, I can understand it, but, I'm not sure it was a great idea. You know, some of the other things that came out during the election, didn't agree with some of the boutique cuts and all the rest. But, you know, on the whole, who do I think is going to protect Canadian rights and move our economy in the right direction? It's the liberals. But you know, my support as a small L liberal is tempered by walking in eyes wide open and being able to say, you know, they're not perfect. There's stuff that I don't agree with, but on the whole, I do. But I do get the same sort of thing that you do, you know, from some people who are a little more rah-rah, and they go like, well, how can you say that? You're only helping out the Conservatives or the NDP. Oddly enough, you know, the people who give me the toughest time aren't necessarily even the Conservatives this last election. I was getting a lot of grief from some of my NDP friends and followers, because yeah, I give them fairly gentle criticism about the way they're running their campaign. And, they would come after me like anything on social media because they
knew it was true.
Well,
because, when you point out a weakness, if you point out a weakness that isn't a weakness, people tend to be less concerned, less alarmed. When you point out a weakness that is actually a weakness that other people may come to see as, you're right, that's a weakness, that's when they, you know, partisans of that particular party become alarmed. So the reason that they were freaking out is because they knew you were right.
Well, you know, I would love to think so. I go on, against, their favorite little bugbears, which is favorite representation. Not a big proportional representation person. I understand why the Westminster system was developed the way it did. And I like to say, every vote counts, but not every vote elects. And, there's all kinds of proportional representation. It's got all kinds of, depending on your system, hairs and...
Well, we've had, I think...
on it, too.
What if we had 21 governments since World War II in Canada, 23 governments, whereas Italy has had 61 under proportional representation? And in Israel, you look at Israel, where small parties of ultra-religious parties that do not in any way reflect the broad majority of Israeli opinion, right or left, wind up holding the balance of power and wind up getting concessions made that the rest of the country doesn't agree with. And how is that more democratic? It's not. I voted for the Liberals the first time around in spite of the pledge for electoral reform. I don't want to see it. Because I think that each system has problems. And you know what? Let's just leave things the way they are, because none of the others are so much better that it's worth the aggravation of changing to them. But boy, those people who believe in electoral reform, I think the Liberals should have come out and been really put this issue to bed a good 4 to 6 months before the election, so that it didn't become something that turned off a lot of young voters. Unfortunately, they were distracted by the actions of Jody Wilson-Raybould and something called SNC-Lavalin. And so if they had planned that at the time, that couldn't happen. And it's interesting, you mentioned you haven't been a member of a political party in years. Last political party I was actually a member of was the Progressive Conservative Party of Ontario. and so that's how far back that is. But just and you mentioned the term shill. You mentioned the fact that you would post a support for a particular policy or for a party or for the liberals or something, and you'd be called a shill. Now, a shill is somebody who is taking some kind of reward in exchange for an insincere endorsement.
I wish that was the case.
Yeah, I had people asking me how much
cash.
I had people ask me how much I was getting paid by the liberals, and was I getting, how much of that media bailout was I getting? And the answer is goose egg, you know, zero. But the fact that we introduced into, again, this is part of introducing American style campaigning. The idea that, no, it's not that, I'll take myself as an example. It's not that I was tweeting support of a particular policy because I actually legitimately agree with that policy and it lines up with my personal values. No, it's because I'm a shill. It doesn't matter to me what the policy is. I am just insincerely supporting one side, one party, because that's what you do, because you support every single thing that party says. Even though there was evidence, if you read my social media, that no, that wasn't the case, that tends to get ignored because people only, you know, notice when something hurts, you know, when they say, ow. When it doesn't hurt, it goes past them. But again, that notion of people weren't expressing legitimate political values. They were actually just shills, just mindless cheerleaders who had been in some way bought off, either with money or identity or something else. That the debate we were having wasn't between people who had different visions of the country or different views of policy. It was between shills, people who were just fundamentally insincere. And that is something that was new that I'd never encountered in previous campaigns.
And I'll tell you, you know, my greatest moment of personal irony during the campaign was when Warren Kinsella, after blocking me, after having said some things about Jody Wilson-Raybould and his possible involvement in all of that sort of thing. So just after he blocked me, like 30 seconds after, he tweeted out that a lot of people are in the pay of the PMO for their tweets, and Lawton's might be one of them. I'm like, wait a second. The irony, as it turns out in subsequent events, was, of course, that we find out that Kinsella was being hired by All and Sundry, sometimes on the sly, to run dark campaigns and social media things. Especially the working for the Conservatives, this guy who supposedly was in the Cretchen war room, and, you know, people who are on the inside say, you know, that's really a stretch to say that even at that time. But,
Well, I think he identified as a liberal insider. And when a new generation came in with the Trudeau administration, who said, thank you for your service, it's no longer required.
I think he said Kinsella who.
He turned bitter. And, you know, Jerry Nichols is a guy on the Conservative side who had the ear of the PM. The Conservative PM, he had his time in office and was shuffled out of a place of influence. And he didn't act like a baby. You know, he took it, he went, reinvented himself as a political consultant and a writer. Yep. And I respect that, because people need to recognize, while you're a part of the in-group now, there's going to be a time when you're out of that in-group. And Warren Kinsella's identity, I guess, was so wrapped up in being this liberal insider that he just turned so bitter that many elements of his life, and I won't go into too many details, but many elements of his life, not just political, fell apart because of this unceasing bitterness at, and listen, I'm over 50. I know what ageism is. I know what it's like for people to glance at your resume and say, oh, there's too many things on this resume. Obviously, you've lived too long. You're obviously too old, and not even get a response. Ageism is real. Great article in Forbes that I read last week about the fact that men in their 50s and above can't get jobs because employers would rather hire two snot-nosed 22-year-olds and pay them half of what they'd pay somebody with experience. And anybody older just gets pushed by the wayside. I believe that in a few years, we're going to see companies coming back begging people in their 50s. Can you please come back? Because these 22-year-olds don't know shit, and the companies are going into the toilet. But I understand ageism. I understand feeling like the industry you've devoted yourself to and that you were a part of now has said, hasta la vista, baby. I understand that feeling of hurt. I can relate to that, but I can't relate to the unremitting bitterness of Warren Kinsella that he was willing to work for the Greens. And then when the Green Party membership said, you hired who? They shuffled him out, you know, politely. And he went and worked for the Conservatives, anything to try to unseat Trudeau. I can't relate to that bitterness, but that bitterness was a component in what was going on in this election. There was bitterness, there was rancor. And I just wonder how much of that, Stephen, do you think is legitimate and permanent versus something that was generated by algorithms?
Yeah, and I don't know how much of it, you know, going forward, whether or not it's like a vaccine and we've had a little bit of it now and maybe we're a little bit more immune because we're a little more open-eyed. I mean, I think Canadians are now, because of this election, slightly better consumers of political information because people were trading saying, well, you know, that's not a reliable site. I mean, there was lots of fact-checking going on and all the rest. So I think, you know, we're a little more wary than some of our well, at least we like to think, are a little more wary and a little more savvy than some of our neighbors to the south when it comes to consuming this kind of stuff. And I think that's why some of these memes kind of fell flat and some of the mean-spirited stuff, you know, it always resonates within a small community, whether or not it is bot-driven or troll-driven or you know, paid for as part of the dark arts of backroom politics. But I think, you know, Canadians kind of looked at it. And I think one of the nice things about this election is we rejected a couple of important things. I mean, the rejection of the People's Party of Canada, which certainly, you know, they claim, well, we never were really racist. We were, we were portrayed that way.
We were racist adjacent.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The guy next to me, you should see him. But they got 1.6% of the popular vote. I think that's a pretty good rejection of it. I think the fact that the Conservatives were called out on an awful lot of their over-the-top stuff, whether it was immigrant or religious right or that sort of thing, I think that bodes well for Canada as well. I think it's the Greens.
They're the Greens.
They're the Greens. I mean, they don't really have a coherent political philosophy, which is that held them back because all their candidates. I mean, their candidates, they grabbed whoever they could in a lot of cases. So they weren't exactly top tier people. They didn't do an awful lot of vetting and background checking on some of these people, and some of them had some pretty strange backgrounds. One of them came out. It was a woman in BC, and she had bought a human skull for her boyfriend for his birthday. And there's pictures on Facebook of him with this human skull. It's the best present I've ever had. and they ran a tattoo parlor, and they came up with this great story about, oh, I need it like as a life art model for some of the tattoos I do. It's like, well, we have this new thing. It's called the internet. There's lots of pictures on it. You don't actually need a human skull on your.
Yeah, but the Greens, the Greens are the Greens. They've always been a bit of the wacky, the wacky party. I don't know. They really haven't been making great electoral gains over the last few elections. I don't know why, since the NDP and Liberals have strong policies that focus on the environment, I don't even know why the Green Party exists anymore. I don't know about you, but I don't think that Maxime Bernier's party will even be around to contest the next election. I think they can hold their membership meetings now in a phone booth. And I think that the whole party was Maxime Bernier hating Andrew Scheer and being mad that he didn't get the leadership of the Conservative Party. It was something done out of spite.
There's a big part of that, too.
Yeah, it was not really actually a party. It was more, hey, help me beat up on Andrew Scheer. Because it was the same motivation as Kinsella. I wasn't chosen. I'm not part of that group. And so I'm going to be a spoiler as much as possible. And he really wasn't, and he wasn't significant. And I think even odds whether Trudeau will be the Liberal leader leading the Liberals into the next election. Certainly during this campaign, his heart just did not seem in it, and I don't blame him, because how can you for 6 months have the crap beaten out of you every day, hour after hour, as well as I think his own sense of personal shame at those things that he did in the past, because I think that he legitimately regrets those things, and it was embarrassed. He seemed like Rocky in Rocky III in the beginning when he was training, but he hadn't finally admitted he just didn't want it no more. Justin Trudeau is somebody who didn't want to run to be the leader of the Liberal Party when he did, but the party had been decimated to 39 seats and they had no other saviors. And so for the good of the party, he stepped in. He took them from 39 seats to a majority. But that wasn't when his timing, he had young kids. This isn't really when he wanted to do it, but he did it. And then he had the crap beat out of him for months, even before this election. I can understand why somebody would be saying, you know what? I did this for the sake of the party and for the country, because I believe in the vision of the Liberal Party. But I think this minority government's going to last a while, because the NDP's broke. They can't afford to contest another election and make a budget fall apart. But I don't know.
I was saying the same thing. I think he's probably got pretty close to 4 years in him, because I don't think, I mean, he's got two different minority parties that he can go to. He can go to the Bloc, and he can go to the NDP. And they're, the Bloc, they've got no interest in forming starting another election. The leader actually said that in the week following the election, saying, I think he actually said, governments are elected for 4 years. I expect to be here for 4 years. And the NDP, like you said, they're broke. They came to this election broke. The change in election finances laws were brought in by the Conservatives mostly to beat up on the NDP, because they got rid of the per vote subsidy, which the NDP survived on, and got rid of the ability of unions to be able to contribute money. And so the NDP is stuck with little individual 10 and 20 buck donations. And they were, was in 2018, they took a $12 million mortgage on their headquarters in Ottawa. And they've been consistently underperforming in their fundraising, so they're going to come out of this election owing a ton of money.
Yeah, there's no stomach for another election. So no. I think we can see this will be a fairly stable minority. I mean, how many years did Harper govern with a minority? So this is a fairly stable minority. But I don't know that Justin Trudeau will be the Liberal leader in the next election. I don't know if 2 years in, he doesn't say, you know what, I'm going to be stepping aside and letting some other people come in. Or is he going to be summoning the ghost and the spirit of his late father and say, no, damn it, I'm going to run again and I'm going to win? Because Pierre Trudeau, in his second mandate, was reduced to a minority after a majority and came back again. It'll determine, I mean, people say, where is Trudeau now? Is he hiding? I mean, obviously, he's been consulting with people.
he's probably sleeping. God,
but he's probably, he's consulting with people as to how to shape this next government and avoid the problems as before. And I think as long as Butts isn't brought back, and maybe they get rid of Ben Chin, because that PMO, the thing that stood out from the Ethics Commissioner's report is that the PMO was run like the Keystone Cops. People going and doing things. Now, granted, the law that they violated was exceptionally subjective, but they weren't telling the Prime Minister about meetings they had or the results of the meetings they had. They were running around, and the PMO was controlling that, and that was Butts. And so why he went to Butts to run the campaign is another question. Loyalty to your friends is a wonderful thing, but I think Justin Trudeau chooses the wrong people for key positions, but I'm not sure he's going to be the guy. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a leadership convention. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised to see Chrystia Freeland leading, carrying the Liberal banner in the next election, because Trudeau will be a tired force by then unless he gets reinvigorated. And the Conservatives are going to have a new leader, a young, probably a younger leader, somebody who's more to the center. They say Conservatives will never forgive Peter MacKay for merging the PCs with the Reform Party. The fact is he had no choice because there was no real PC party at that point in time. I think they'll get past that. They'll have somebody, if it's not Peter MacKay, it'll be somebody Peter MacKay-like, who is young and who embodies some of the same things and appeals as Trudeau. He looks the part. He's young, vibrant, you know, got a pretty wife, that kind of thing.
Or pretty husband.
Listen, you never know. Canada is very accepting. I mean,
we don't want to get letters.
Who would expect that Pete Buttigieg in the United States, an openly gay man, would still be one of the top contenders on the Democratic side? And this is a great thing. But I can see us going into the next election with the NDP keeping Jagmeet Singh, but I can see the two main parties, Liberal and Conservative, having completely different leaders. And that may be the thing that tells us whether this election, with its rancor and its bitterness and its you're a traitor, continues, or if we return to something more Canadian, which is something that is more a matter of accepting the civility of the process and the good intentions of your opponents, and that your opponents are your opponents and your rivals and not your enemies. I think the next election is going to be exceptionally important because it'll determine whether this election was an anomaly or if this is the new normal. And if this is the new normal, I don't like the new normal.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, on the other side of it too, I mean, the concern that Peter MacKay, before he walked back his comments, was, you know, critical of Scheer, saying like, it's like not scoring on an open net. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, Trudeau being more handicapped, you know, the Liberals being more handicapped in this election going in and all the way through with, you know, the body blows that they just had, you know, one clunker after another. And yet, and Scheer and the Conservatives, they out-fundraised the Liberals. The Liberals were raising $7 million, the Conservatives were raising 10. And in the last week and a half, 2 weeks of the campaign, but all through the campaign, but especially in the last 10 days, there was such a media buy by the Conservatives. You couldn't turn on the radio and not hear.
My wife, Leanna, thinks that hurt them because she knows.
I think it did too.
Yeah, because she knows that one of her favorite shows is Forged in Fire. It's a show where people make swords and stuff. It's completely non-political. And having that interrupted by Andrew Scheer's kisser all through with ads, it pissed her off because she went there. She watches that show to get away from politics, to get away from the real world and the rancor and the stuff like that. And to have his face there, I think that they overbought. And I think one of the good things this election showed is that Canadians can't be bought in the U.S., the party with the most amount of money usually is the party that is victorious. In Canada, no, that's not necessarily the case. We're not, because we don't have one or two traits that are Canadian, we don't respond to dog whistles the same way. In fact, when we're aware that they're dog whistles, we react in the opposite way. They don't convince us to be suspicious and go with the person blowing the dog whistle. They convince us to go against them because we have a general sense of fair play in this country and camaraderie, and we're all in it together, that the U.S., with its emphasis on unbridled capitalism and its lack of a proper social safety net and the, you know, I got mine, you get yours attitude. Our countries have been diverging for years. There's a great book called Fire and Ice, which is, I think it's probably about 10 years old now, a little out of date, but it documented just how Canada and the U.S. have been diverging socially for the past 15, 20 years. And this election, I was proud that we couldn't be bought, that votes could not be bought, and that in the end, Canadians, when they went to cast their ballot, they had to decide who, you know, where did their heart lie and who did they trust more. And I will say that keep an eye on young voters. Because I know that when I was involved in doing some exit polling out in Halifax, the young, mostly white, end of the millennial generation that was voting, said that the blackface stuff was unforgivable. These are people who are too young to have enough life experience to have...
they haven't made enough mistakes yet. Well, they've
made the mistakes. They don't have the perspective yet to look back and recognize they were mistakes. Yeah. So at this point in time, and if you ask them, have you ever made mistakes? They say, yeah, but I never did blackface. No, you didn't make that mistake. You made another mistake. And in fact, they may be making mistakes now that at this point in time, we don't consider mistakes. But in 10 years and in 20 years, we'll recognize.
Look back and go, what the hell were you thinking?
That's the nature of progress. But it'd be interesting to see, because I found them to be exceptionally unforgiving. This generation that is constantly telling us, don't judge. Don't judge.
Oh, it's an incredibly judgy generation.
Oh, yeah. Don't judge people who are trans. Don't judge people who are gay. Don't judge people who are non-binary. And I agree with all of those things. But they are very, very loud about don't judge. And yet I found them to be the most rigidly judgmental, unforgiving group of people that I spoke to. The most forgiving people I found were people of color who, when I brought up to them the black face or the brown face, many of the people who are, who we consider brown said, I've never even heard of brown face before this. And it wasn't. And they said, you know what? Almost every one of them I noted, interestingly, actually included the wave of a hand. When they said, please, I don't care about what he did all those years ago. What he's done for us in the past 4 years has been significant. This man's not a racist because of what he did all those years ago. We face racism every single day, and this man is not a racist. And that was interesting to me, too, is that the people who should have been
most offended
were the ones who said, yes, this was a mistake, and yes, I'm disappointed in him. But I also recognize that it was years ago, and I'm going to judge the man and not the boy. And the youth vote went from Liberal to NDP because they just couldn't forgive Justin Trudeau for doing something at an age that many of them are at now. And I'd be curious to see. You know, it's just like
difference, four years might make.
Well, I mean, where did yuppies come from? They used to be hippies. People who didn't believe in possessions and were all free love became people who cared exclusively about possessions and getting their own and making more money.
Their granite countertops. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Things change. So that's an interesting bit of the electorate to watch. They gain more experience and perhaps become more forgiving as life teaches them lessons, be interested to see if that vote goes back to the Liberals, and maybe if it's a different leader, it will. But I'll tell you this. I like Justin Trudeau, the human being, the imperfect human being who, the angel with dirty wings. Far better than I liked the Justin Trudeau who was giving me talking points of pure sanctimony and high horse nature that I didn't feel were really him. Listen, I'm a liberal-minded guy. I felt judged, by some of the things he said, and I don't disagree with his values, but the way they went about it, it pissed me off. It wasn't enough to make me a conservative again, but it pissed me off. And I think he's free now to not have to be the archangel Justin.
I think this election has been, could be and should be transformational for both Justin Trudeau for exactly that reason, that I think he has come out of this thing chastened and a little more mature and maybe a little more serious about government itself. And like you said, getting the PMO under control, having some adults running it. His father, Pierre Trudeau, had Keith Davey and had Pitfield and had Jim Coutts and, people who were really good political pros.
Yeah, the Rainmaker.
Who I had the pleasure of knowing really well. And, he had those people running things and they ran pretty well. I mean, they had bumps and all the rest. But I think it could be transformational for Trudeau in this term, which might be his last term or might be one of several, but I think he comes back from this election chastened and wiser and maybe a little less judgy and sanctimonious, which I think will resonate and be really, really good. On the other side, I think if the conservatives are smart, and that's, you know, sometimes a big if.
This is debatable.
It's a big if. Yeah. They will realize that, as Peter McKay said, you know, we missed scoring on an empty net here. What we did doesn't work. It has reduced us to a rump regional party. We are now back to our reform roots of being an Alberta, Saskatchewan oil and gas and wheat party, with some of you know, rural Ontario thrown in. We've been all but shut out of Quebec. We are, you know, the Maritimes, you know, they even didn't buy us in great numbers this time. BC is always a bit of a mix. But if we ever want to be anything more than the old Preston Manning Reform Party, then we have to stop being social conservatives. We have to actually not just tolerate, but embrace, you know, the charter and diversity and immigration and all those other things. And, you know, basically in elections, stop being dicks, you know, really stop, you know, with the
Canadians
fake...
don't like dicks.
They don't. They don't like the fake memes. They don't being lied to. They don't like, you know, hearing people badmouth. They don't like.
And they may not know what the lie is. They may not know what the truth is, but they recognize that what's being said is a lie. And I mean, you talk about diversity on the one of the first 2 days of the election. Andrew Scheer tweeted, here is our diverse group of people that are, you know, that are our candidates.
Yes,
and they were varying shades of white.
Well, I saw that
there was not a person of color among them.
Yeah, but two of those guys had a beard. So, you know, that represents a significant minority. Yeah,
Each one of them had a different first name. You know, like that was his version of diversity. And I think they also went into this campaign. Listen, Andrew Scheer was leader because none of the more serious contenders wanted to take that job because they thought that Trudeau would likely coast easily to a second victory. And they wanted to keep their powder dry to when his government's a little longer in the tooth and he can be judged by two terms worth of mistakes, which governments invariably make, and their record. And so Andrew Scheer was little more than a heating pad in a seat for the more serious yep. candidates. And that's why, I mean, there was nothing to this man. The fact that he wound up getting an opportunity, I mean, Mike Harris was similarly a heating pad back in the day for guys like Dennis Timbrell and some of the more serious people who had been for years jockeying to build support, Cam Jackson, to be the leader. They were like, yeah, let this golf guy run the party because we're going to lose the next election, but we have the chance of winning after that. So let's let this guy warm the seat for us for this period of time. And then circumstances changed, and lo and behold, the heating pad became the premier. And Andrew Scheer, he went into this, the Conservatives went into this campaign, if you consider Doug Ford and his unpopularity, and the need to win Ontario, really, to win government, they went into this campaign as an albatross with an albatross around its neck, with Scheer and Ford. And I think that, I think Ontario's sick of Ford. I think that unless he substantially changes his ways, that manner of conservatism is on its way out. And if liberals...
he's changed his stripes. It's been like two weeks. And
yeah, a man like that simply cannot stop being who he is.
And
I think he will be removed from office electorally in the next election if the Liberals manage to, you know, elect a leader who's the least bit likable. Andrea Horvath is not going to become premier. She's
on the side of a milk carton. I don't know where she's been.
And you know, that time during the campaign when, I forget the specifics, but somebody did something that was sort of satirical at one of her events that she could have gone and laughed with him. Instead, she complained about it and was bitter. And you know what? Nobody wants a leader that they wouldn't want to have a conversation with. And somebody who is humorless is someone you don't want to have a conversation with. She comes across as a scold, and no one wants to elect a scold. We did.
Yep.
Stephen Harper was a scold. But there is obviously different gender dynamics, male and female scolds.
And going to his election, Justin Trudeau was a scold as well. And he paid the price for that.
Yeah. And so it'll be interesting to see. I think a lot is going to hinge on whether the fiscal conservatives, but social liberal part of the Conservative Party finally stands up. They started to last week and say Scheer has to go and we have to start changing our ways. And, you know, as much as Peter McKay walked back his comments, those comments are out there. Oh. You know, the jury will disregard.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they're there. And he said them. He's from a political family, too. His father, Elmer, was a cabinet minister.
Politics in the Maritime is bare knuckle boxing, too.
Yeah. So I think that everything in the next election, what we're going to see in the next election, as far as rancor and bitterness and you're a traitor and all of that, I think a lot of that is hinging upon who the next leader of the Conservative Party is and who that leader chooses to surround himself with. Are they going to pick a founder of Rebel Media to run things for them? Or are they going to pick somebody who is a little bit smarter and understands and is more attuned to the values, the core values of Canadians and Canadian sense of fair play and fair comment? So really all eyes, as far as going forward to the next election, I think have to be on the choices made by the Conservative Party.
Yep. No, absolutely. They have a chance to make their tent more bigger and more appealing to people who are in the center, who are, I think, are naturally willing to consider them. But, you know, the way they ran this campaign this time, but, you know, not just the policies, and it's odd because being a liberal shill, I look at the conservative policies and I thought, I would probably benefit more from a conservative government personally than I would from a liberal government. I mean, just, you know, the tax breaks and all the rest of the kind of stuff. I mean, as we started off our show, you know, I'm a person of privilege. You know, I don't have to worry. I don't have precarious employment. I don't, have to worry about a roof over my head. There's lots of things I don't have to worry about in being precarious in society. So the conservative naturally would be a great landing ground for me if all I was concerned about was me. I'm concerned about bigger issues than just me. And there's lots of things I think that are good for Canada that, you know, personally, I can do without, even though they'd personally benefit me. But I think the conservatives, there's a lot of people out there who say, yeah, give me a reason to vote conservative. And they just didn't. They didn't give them any reason. They said, you know, they saw them with the yellow vesters. They saw them with Ezra Levant writing op-eds for the Globe and Mail. They saw, you know, whisper campaigns that were being started in social media by people who are, you know, part of the Manning or the Strong and Proud things.
It's like, and they were those whisper campaigns, by the way, were really despicable. They were really, I think that the Liberals got an injunction against the Globe and Mail for even publishing.
No, actually they didn't.
They didn't? Story?
It was a story and it was part of, and that the injunction itself was part of the whisper campaign because they said, the story was so bad that they had to get an injunction. And it turns out there was, you know, they went through all the court records. There was no injunction.
I think the reason it didn't appear is because the Globe and Mail couldn't get corroborated sources that were credible.
Well, not only that. I mean, it was more than that. They went, this is the same story about Trudeau leaving the high school because he was dating a soccer mom or a student or something. And there was a scandal.
Salacious.
And I know that the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail both sent people out there to investigate the story. And they came back and they said, not only can we not corroborate it, there's absolutely nothing to the story. We've talked to everybody and everyone says, no, that's not true. It's not just, you know, no comment. It's not true. And so then the story got floated. Oh, it was so bad that the Liberals had to resort to the courts and get an injunction to stop the story from coming out as part of the cover-up. And it's like, no, that didn't happen either. Anyway,
I remember Warren Kinsella and I think Robert Fife, saying, oh, some story's going to drop tomorrow. Certainly was Kinsella. Story's going to drop tomorrow, and that'll be the end of Trudeau. And the story didn't drop. And I think that probably drove him even more crazy. And I would like to also just say, just sort of as a personal thing, there were people during this campaign who blamed Lisa Kinsella, who had married Warren Kinsella, and was a member of his Daisy Group consulting company, as complicit in what Warren Kinsella did and tarred her with the same brush as him. And if you look at her social media during the period of the election and before, there is not a single retweet or support of Warren Kinsella's campaign or tone. And she's no longer a member of the Daisy group. Take from that, I can't say anything more, but take from that what you will. But the notion that people had that, of course, she's the wife, so of course she's equally responsible and will support everything the husband does, was an indication there's still some old-fashioned attitudes in this country that really need to change. Because Lisa Kinsella is, in my encounters with her, a very fine, decent human being, and had no truck or trade with any of the things that that Warren was doing. And I think she came out a little beat up because there was a photograph of her embracing Jody Wilson-Raybould. And as she said to me, I've known her for years, so I am not going to just snub somebody because I might not support what she's doing.
And there was
politically
a lot of speculation at that time about it, and whether who was the source and all the rest. But
yeah, but you know, she's
and I don't know either of them. I've never met Warren. I've never met Lisa. Ever since Warren blocked me and I blocked him, I try to speak his name as little as possible.
I used to, in case of like Beetlejuice, he'll appear. I had never had a bad encounter really with Warren Kinsella, and then I was blocked.
I had Twitter stuff back and forth with him. It was fairly jovial, and then the Wilson-Raybould thing, and I think I said something about, this is kind of not great. And, I wasn't being my usual smartassy kind of thing either. I just said, this is just kind of distasteful, and next thing I know, I was blocked. So that was the end of that. I tried not to pay attention, except when it hits the front page of the big papers.
But, yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Stephen. This has been great. It's been
Hey, we're going to do terrific. This again, aren't we?
Yes. Next week's show, we're going next to focus okay. on religion in Canadian
Not
politics.
Not controversial at all.
Well, the difference, again, talking about the divergence between the electorate and the tone in the United States and in Canada, the difference between how we treat the religious ethics and associations of political candidates in Canada versus how they're treated in the United States. Because there's a giant gulf, a chasm in our attitudes. And if you want to, in preparation for that, listeners, Google Stockwell Day. That might be an interesting primer. But we treat...
Or the Toronto Separate School Board, which is, brought it back to the forefront last week.
And we'll be talking about that, and because that's an interesting issue. And certainly religion played a role in determining the outcome of this past election. We'll talk about all of that next week on Stephen and Stephen. And you can find Stephen Lawton's, on Twitter and Facebook, or just Twitter? I know
my Facebook, I don't do politics on Facebook just because it's okay. it's a bit of a swamp, but on Twitter, just at Stephen Lawton's.
Lautens.
That's me.
That's right. And Stephen with a PH?
With a PH.
Yes.
You're the Stephen with the V.
I'm at Stephen with a V, Stephen J. Kersner. I don't do very much on my personal Twitter. I really need to get to it and get on it. But now that we're doing this podcast again, I think that more conversations will happen there as well. But thank you very much for listening, and continue to support FU Politics. We've done remarkably well. We talked about podcast about all the dark money the Conservatives had and how they fed it to media proxies to attack people with liberal backgrounds. I was a victim of, I think, at least two articles from sites that were directed by liberal or by conservative dark money. Liberals don't have dark money. And so we're trying
liberals
to
are notoriously cheap.
Yes. we are trying to restore with FU Politics and the FU Network. And FU stands basically for an attitude, but also FU stands for us, because we're trying to restore a type of conversation about politics, social events, and soon music and pop culture and stuff that is at the level of real people, that sounds like the way real people speak to each other, not in jargonese, not intended to make the speaker seem more intelligent than the person they're speaking to, or than the audience. Grassroots stuff, we sound like you, we talk with you, not at you. And that form of media, that tier of media, disappeared for a number of reasons in Canada. And we're trying to bring it back. But to do that, we need your support. So this is where I pull out the tin cup and say that if you can support us through a subscription on patreon.com, it starts at $1 a month. And you can give as much as you want. I understand that for some people, $50 a month is the same as, for other people, $1 a month, as far as how much they're going to miss that money. $1 a month may be very significant for you, and every dollar is appreciated. Certainly our colleagues at Canada Land are earning something like $30,000 a month on Patreon. They're doing fine work as well. We're building the next tier of media that is people-centered. So if you like conversations you can follow without $15 words, without people being in love with, so in love with philosophies and ideologies that you don't get actual conversation. And if you like conversation that sounds like conversation you'd like to be a part of, then please support us. Go to Patreon. That's Patreon, patreon.com/FUNetworkTV, and give us some money there. Or if you want to boost us with a one-time boost at PayPal, you do that through PayPal, and our email address for that is funetworktv@gmail.com. And come back next week for more of Stephen and I talking politics. Stephen, it's been a pleasure. It's been too long.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. Yeah.
And I look forward to next week. And everyone out there, feel free to add your comments. And we may bring up some of those comments when we do our discussions. But please keep it civil, because one of the hallmarks of the FU Network and FU Politics is that we insist that everybody be civil, respectful, and maintain a sense of humor, because the surest sign that you have lost your perspective and perhaps lost your grip is when you can't laugh about something. Not laugh at people, not punch down, but when you lose your ability to find the humor in some of the absurdities of life and the things that we discuss in politics and current affairs, that's when you really need to take stock. So a sense of humor is important in our programming, but as well, civility and mutual respect, criticize ideas, not people. So continue that in the comments as well. And Stephen, thank you very much. We'll talk again next week.
This is fun! The FU Network!